Hey folks, so this week I have a treat for you. About a month ago at the Greater New York Hospital Association, 16 intensivists gathered together for a pro-con debate on various topics, and I was matched against a gentleman named Paul Mayo. Now, anyone familiar with critical care ultrasound already knows his name. He is one of the best teachers of critical care ultrasound. He runs the ICU at Long Island Jewish Hospital in Long Island here in New York. Really, really smart guy. And the topic we were debating is, should paralytics be part of the drug package for critical care intubation? I was on the pro side, as you would expect, and Dr. Mayo took the con. So each of us had 10 minutes to make our case. So we're going to go right into that now. And then afterwards, I'll tell you some of my thoughts. And then I want to have you vote on the question of, should paralytics be used for ICU intubations by critical care fellows? That's how I've rephrased the question, because I really think the question in the ED has already been answered. But I will leave that to you. All right, let's get on with it. All right, so I've devoted most of my nascent career to the idea that peri-intubation deaths are preventable. Because every time you pick up a laryngoscope, essentially, you're being given a license to kill. And we know what kills patients during intubation these days. You have to avoid desaturation, you have to avoid hypotension, and you have to maximize your chances of first pass success, meaning you get in the mouth and the tube goes in on the first try. And the way that's become the standard for this is rapid sequence intubation, the simultaneous provision of a sedative and a paralytic. Now, there's this concept in the anesthesia world, and I'm married to one of these anesthesiologists, so I have feedback on a constant basis, of facilitated intubation, the idea of sedative-only intubation. They use this on their elective operative patients. There's not an anesthesiologist out there that thinks this is a good idea on an emergent crash intubation. So I don't even know why we're having this debate. Now, the question is not, can we intubate without paralytics? Of course we can. I did it on the ambulance as a medic with no meds. When I was an intern, I did it with 2 milligrams of Ativan. You could do it. That's not the question. See, one of my mentors, when I propose things like this, would tell me, Scott, if you put on a blindfold and walk across the street, 9 times out of 10, you'll be just fine. But that doesn't make it a good idea. Right? Anesthesiology looked at this 1988, decades ago, and they found it didn't work. They had a control group in these two studies that didn't get paralytics, and the results were dismal compared to paralytics. Now, I thought the issue was abandoned, but no, in 1999, again, very good sedative regimen, with or without rocuronium, randomized trial. In the no paralytic group, 65% unacceptable intubating conditions versus 0 in the paralytic group. But then, again in 2003, this is unethical from my opinion that they kept testing this, but they did it again. And again, very nice dose of sedative with or without paralytics, 70% poor intubating conditions in the control group versus 2% in the succinylcholine group. Seems pretty easy to figure out the answer here. But again, the same guy, try it again. And again, 25% failed, 45% poor intubating conditions in the no paralytic group. They kept on going. They didn't stop. Anesthesia analgesia in 1997, 19 out of 20 patients had poor or impossible conditions with fentanyl and thiopental, a very nice sedative regimen. 1998, 10 out of 10 poor or impossible after midazolam, fentanyl, and propofol. There's been a host of other studies looking at poorer sedative agents, but I'm not even going to bore you with them, because you can make an argument that they're not enough sedative in order to really do the job, but they're out there. Now the question is, what if we use a ton? What if we use a ton of sedative agent? What if we just kept giving propofol, we added on fentanyl, and we sprayed the cords? They randomized them, 2 groups. One got sedatives only, one got the cords sprayed as well, and you can see in the propofol, alfentanil group only, a third of the patients had poor or impossible conditions. Now, the first line of that study I found particularly interesting. Several investigators have found that intubation of the trachea is possible without paralytics. Yes, I know that. That's not the question. The question is it as good? That's the question I want you to have in your mind. That's the question I want you to be asking right now. Because paralytics are already the perfect answer to this situation. Now, I'm not going to even pretend succinylcholine is a good drug for the ICU. That would be a straw man argument. So if anyone's saying, oh, sucks has problems and causes hyperkalemia, yes, you're right, don't use it. Don't ever use sucks on a critically ill patient. They've been lying in bed for a while, maybe not a good idea. Use rocuronium. At a dose of 1.2 to 1.4 milligrams, ideal intubating conditions at the same time course as sucks. If you don't believe me, go to Cochrane, it's there. You're gonna get perfect intubating conditions, and you get them with no side effects at all. Now, this is in a paper that was just recently published. If you give paralytics, you'll have the inability to perform BVM ventilation following a failed intubation. I don't even know what that means. You want a paralyzed patient if you're gonna bag them, so I'm not sure about this. Maybe we'll get clarification in about 5 minutes. But paralysis is the ideal way to go. You see, because if you have a failed intubation, there's basically three choices you can make. You can pray, always a good idea. You can call someone else besides you, or you can actually manage the airway. Now, if you're in these first two categories, you might say to yourself, it's a good idea if those sedatives wear off and the patient wakes up. Well, that works in the elective anesthesia world. But guess what? There was a reason you were intubating that patient in the first place. It doesn't disappear when the propofol wears off. They're still in dire straits needing to be intubated, and now they're worse off because they've shunted from the atelectasis of your intubation attempts. On the other hand, if you're going to manage the airway, what you'll find is that paralysis is a very good thing to have. This is my airway algorithm, came from shock trauma, and for each step on the algorithm, having a paralyzed patient is essential. You don't want to put an LMA in a patient who's pulling it out, and you don't want to do a cricothoracotomy on a moving patient. So paralysis is actually good. Now, Dr. Mayo is way too smart to try to argue this based on the existing data, so I had to say he probably did his own new study that we're going to hear about. And when I heard that as a concept, I thought, well, what kind of study would actually show this? What's the inclusion criteria? Did he actually compare it to a paralytic, or did he just do a prospective cohort trial? Did he have to redose that propofol time after time? Was it blinded? Was there first pass success? And then what were the complication rates? Because we know you can do it, you just can't do it as well. Well, it turns out that I had some spies in white, and this is the abstract you're going to hear about momentarily. Now, they had some complications. Hypotension rate 7%. That's actually not a big deal, though you should bear it in mind. Esophageal intubation, well, this never should happen, but 14% fine. You know, it's fellows doing the intubation, they don't have a problem. But then we get profound desaturation. Saturation below 80% during the intubation attempts, 11% of the patients. Three or more attempts a fifth of the time. Now I'm starting to have some trouble, because we know that desaturation, that hypotension, that first pass success is what keeps patients safe during intubation. Now, I'll just mention one more trial just published, largest trial to date of emergency intubations, over 8,900 patients. If you did it with paralytics, 97% success rate. If you did it without, 91%. And the adverse event rate was 1.7 times higher in the patients that didn't get paralytics. So again, I'll tell you, if you put on a blindfold and cross the street, 9 times out of 10, you'll be just fine. But it's not us that's getting hit by the car in that 1 out of 10 times. It's our patients, and we should keep them safe. Because every time we pick up that blade, we're being given a license to kill. And it goes to how much we want to give them the maximal chance of success as to what regimen we'll choose. And with that, I thank you for your attention.
I press here?
There's a clicker.
I know there is.
The arrow.
The arrow, which one?
That one.
It's the most dangerous procedure in the ICU. The real studies, not the EM studies, measure true complication rate. Haber, Mort, the BC group say when you line up, 2 to 3% of the patients are going to be dead within half an hour from complication of intubation. That's the highest rate of death of any procedure we do. There's a very high rate of hypoxemia and hypotension. If only the EM groups would not focus on success, but rather on complication. Only the anesthesia people have described this extraordinarily high rate of hypoxemia, hypotension. And it's well known that nobody reports complications honestly. That's reported, the anesthesia people know this. ED literature is obsessed with success. I say we should be obsessed with physiology. We all know that our patients are not the same as in the OR. Those are in the paradise of the OR. You load them up with a couple of liters of oxygen, you lay them out, and you can look at the Wall Street Journal for 5 minutes before you have to intubate these people. Instead, the risk of desaturation and hypotension is extremely high in our population, you'd agree, because these people are really, really sick. The rules of the OR do not apply in the ICU. And we all know, as we said, you knock them out, you get the tube in. The alternative is what I would call a graded sedative approach. You may occasionally look for full induction with a big dose, but most often the careful intensivist uses incremental doses to maintain some degree of spontaneous respiration, because that's always better than the alternative, which is a failed bagging attempt after intubation fails. This depends on the clinical situation, so that's what we're comparing. So, I'll ask the group, what happens if an ICU group says anesthesiology is banned from my ICU? They're no longer welcome here. What happens if the ICU no longer cherry picks, or the EM group no longer cherry picks? The easy patients. What happens if the fellow has a mandatory 20-hour heavy simulation program, including high-stress scenarios? What happens if the bagging team is no longer a solo operator, but always a highly trained intern team, and that the primary intubator never touches the BVM, ever? What happens if the fellow must execute a 42-point mandatory memorized checklist before they initiate induction? What happens if there's an assigned watcher who's looking at the vital signs and calls them out? A medicator who knows how to give medications when asked and calls back? What happens if every EEI, UEI, urgent endotracheal intubation is followed by a careful debrief so there could be an iterative process of quality improvement? What happens if you can run but you can't hide because the event is taped and not just brushed under the carpet when there's a bad event? You do this so you can improve safety. And what happens if the team no longer blames the patient, but we blame ourselves for our failures? What happens if the team recognizes that first pass success is totally irrelevant? The only thing that's relevant is whether the patient has disordered physiology that will harm them during the procedure. What is this obsession with first pass success? Physiology is what's important. That's the first assignment of the patient. So what happens if the UEI team never, ever, ever, SW, ever uses a paramedic? This is called UEI with sedative alone. And here, you looked at our older data, with that spy in Hawaii, 526 fully monitored UEIs done at two institutions over several calendar periods to show sustainability and transferability. Scott is concerned because complications is misspelled. Sorry. We had hypotension, yes. We had desaturation in those patients where we could not pre-saturate above 90%, a very dangerous population. Death was low. Aspiration, defined as visible passage of stuff through the core, is low. Esophageal intubation is identical to the big anesthesia UAI studies. It's not high, higher than those. We don't tend to knock out teeth. And I'm going to inform SW that if you compare this to honest studies, not the studies from the EV literature, is it first pass success? Well, what about the important stuff? They never report that. These are the lowest rates that have ever been reported in the world literature to date. It's difficult to compare to the ED literature because they only report success rate, okay? They do this because they're obsessed with success of intubation, whereas we are obsessed with physiology. What we've proven then is not that RSI is worse or better than sedative alone. We've just said that you can assume a position of equipoise. They both work. Do we have an agreement on this?
We have an agreement that if you took the same mechanism and put paralytics in, you'd have even better success.
Although we're successful in all cases.
Well, we could talk about defined that during the discussion period.
Yeah, that they're successfully intubated. So why is it a really, really, really bad idea, even though it's equipoise, to actually use sedatives? Well, I'm going to maintain that if an industrial process is the same, has the same outcome, why not use the simpler approach? Especially if the more complicated approach might result in the death of the patient. So they both work, but if one might have lethal outcome, please don't choose that one. There's another reason, reason number two, that if we polled the critical care people in this room, for example, David Chong, are you here? Yes. What do you use in that small hospital uptown? Do you use sedative alone, or do you like to paralyze your people?
Sedative alone.
Thank you. David Berlin, not present. David.
Irwin.
No, David, I'll speak for him. Oh, we don't use those paralytics. That's another little place over there across town. Beth Israel, no paralytics, so seems that people use it. Now, the straw dog is succinylcholine. Unfortunately, the straw dog reigns supreme in New York City. You've selected unsafe but safer agent that sucks, all right? But succinylcholine kills. How? They get hyperkalemia and you don't recognize the risk. Death may occasionally result. The fourth reason is that succinylcholine use or paralytics implies that you're going to be successful. So what happens if you're not successful? That implies that you can bag everyone perfectly. Oh, really? Huh. The sicker they are, the harder they are to bag, and then the team gets locked into the patient's out cold, paralyzed. They suddenly discover it ain't so easy to oxygenate that tight asthmatic or that horrific ARDS patient. All of a sudden, things aren't going like SW told them, I just bag them, you know, and all of a sudden, there's the hurry up. Yeah, get it in. Is it in the esophagus? I don't know. It's in. We're going to. And a minute has gone by, the patient's down to 40%, and they're hypotensive as well. That patient comes to the unit, and they never wake up. 1 minute left. Identification of the aggressor. The anesthesiologists do it, so I guess that's right to do. Yeah, but they work in the OR with perfect conditions. Okay? So remember that. That's hard to do that. And the main reason not to do it is that Scott is an expert. He runs a 7-bed ICU down in the ED at Elm. He can handle stuff, people who are paralyzed. How about in the real jungle out there? Residents, ill-trained attendings are doing this. It's the religion of the RSI. Brain injury, organ injury, occasional death is an epidemic with inappropriate succinylcholine and ROC use. Absolutely in the city, not in your hands, but in the hands of the people who are working in the field. Here is a properly constituted intubation team, okay? This is how we run it, this is how they should be run. You can paralyze, you can do anything you like if you're equipped. This is not what's going on citywide. Instead, the RSI subcultures. I never miss. I can BVN anybody. The K is definitely normal. Anesthesiology does it. My attending does it. Let's suck it up and let's rock and roll.
Incredible stuff, right? So what'd you think? I'll tell you what I thought,
And I didn't have an opportunity to say this stuff at the actual debate, but Dr. Mayo's kind of put two separate questions into his study. And I should say that even though I was debating Dr. Mayo, the first author of that was another excellent gentleman named Seth Koenig. And both of them should really be commended for their work. But they didn't answer the question of should paralytics be used, or are paralytics beneficial, or are they necessary? That wasn't a question their study answered at all. From my way of thinking, their study really showed that if you do an intensive training package, you can make people much better at intubation. And if you run it with a checklist and with a team approach and with a regimented team leadership and role all sorted out beforehand, things work better. I fervently believe that if paralytics were added into that same training program, the results would have been even better. You see, there was a bunch of things unspoken in the abstract and in Dr. Mayo's presentation of what they did. They just kept giving propofol until the patient was essentially in a state of general anesthesia. And that required multiple doses of propofol. And eventually they got to the point where the patient is in a rock-like state. And if all that propofol caused a drop in blood pressure, then they would give vasopressors or inopressors to get the patient's blood pressure back up. Well, that just seems unnecessary. That seems to be prolonging the time to get the intubation done. If they had just given a relatively normal dose of propofol and a paralytic, they would have been able to intubate right away, and there wouldn't be going in and out, and we don't really know what they defined as attempts, and so we don't know how many times they did little tests with the laryngoscope and whether that was considered an attempt or it's only when they actually put the tube in. I don't know. I haven't seen the actual manuscript yet. But the point is that the reason we're obsessed with first pass success in the emergency department is because it matters. Thomas Mort, in an article I'll put in the show notes, very clearly laid out the fact that if you get to more than two attempts, your risk of precipitous desaturation, of complications, of cardiac arrest are much higher. That's why we like first pass success in the ED. That's why anyone should like first pass success. But in a beautiful rhetorical flourish, Dr. Mayo dichotomized the issue. He pretended that if the ED is quote-unquote obsessed with first-pass success, they therefore are not obsessed with physiology. They're not obsessed with preventing desaturation. They're not obsessed with preventing hypotension. But of course, it's not a dichotomized issue. We are obsessed with first-pass success because we understand physiology, because we understand if you give multiple doses of propofol and do multiple attempts, then your risks of desaturation and hypotension are higher. That's why we're obsessed with first-pass success. Now, at the end of the debate, we came to some kind of agreement on the fact that if you do not know how to use difficult airway equipment, that if you don't know how to perform either a needle or surgical cricothyrotomy, if you're not a master of the entire range of the difficult airway algorithm, then maybe paralytics are not the best choice. What I didn't say, and what I'll say to you folks, my listeners, is you probably shouldn't be intubating at all, paralytic or no, if that's the case. There's people in the hospital who are capable of doing that. And if that means letting anesthesia back into your ICU, do it. If it means, and I think Dr. May will be much happier with this, training the fellows to maximize all aspects of difficult airway, which from the framework he describes, he is well capable of doing in his particular intensive care unit, then I am all for that. And what they will quickly find, I believe, is that if they do that, paralytics become, just like it has for anesthesia and emergency medicine, the ideal way of providing intubation. After all, why would we possibly think we could rely on the patient regaining spontaneous respirations as a salvation for a patient in the ICU who required intubation in the first place? I don't know who these patients are. I don't see them in the ED. I don't see patients who I am intubating in the ED who, if I just let them spontaneously breathe, then they'd be able to maintain, because there's a reason I'm intubating them in the first place. So I just don't get it. If he was telling me he was doing this in the anesthesia realm in an elective operative patient, okay, that would make a lot of sense. But that's not what he's saying at all. This is ICU level intubation. So I don't get it. Maybe we'll have Dr. Mayo on the show to, in a non-rhetorical fashion, go back and forth and really explain the concepts. But what I want you to take home is they've really demonstrated that simulation-based training, that making a standard algorithm for airway management, that training people to do this in a really good, rigorous fashion leads to incredibly good results. And for that, Dr. Koenig and Dr. Mayo should be commended. So go to the show notes at mcrit.org. And there you will find a poll. I want you to vote, not on what we should be doing in the ED, not on what we should be doing in anesthesia, but if you were placed as an ICU fellow, let's say you decided to give up this ED racket and start fellowship in a place where anesthesia is not there, should you be using paralytics for your emergent intubations? I want to hear from you. I want to hear from you in the poll. I want to hear from you in the show comments. I want to hear from Dr. Mayo or Dr. Koenig if they're listening. And, oh, one more thing. An article I wrote with Richard Levitan on preoxygenation for intubation has just come out online first in Annals of Emergency Medicine. So if you have access to the journal, just go to the Annals of Emergency Medicine site and go to the articles in press, and you'll find that article by Levitan and myself. And I think we really tried to get all the evidence in there for how to maintain that physiology. With that, I will bid you an excellent week, and I hope to speak to you soon. This is Scott Weingart for the MCRIT podcast, saying bye-bye.